Ready to go. Here we go. And someone will have to say the thing after I say this thing. This week's episode of This Is Only a Test is made possible with support from Storyblocks. Every creator should have a Storyblocks membership. They make it easy for you to bring all your stories to life without having to worry about time, budget, or additional resources. Storyblocks is an ever-growing library of 1 million high-quality, royalty-free stock assets, including 4K footage, music, images, Premiere and After Effects templates, and more. And you can even use Storyblocks if you're a member of a large creative team or marketing agency. Learn more and subscribe today at storyblocks.com/onlyatest. Again, that's storyblocks.com/onlyatest.
Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, February 18th, 2021. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Hello and welcome to the show this week. It's Norm here, joined by, we got a full crew. We got Jeremy Williams.
What up, brothers? The show.
Good to see you. I know you skipped last week because you had no interest in talking about the Super Bowl.
Yeah, well, that is true. That is not the reason I skipped, but we'll go with that. Yeah.
Yeah. And Kishore's here.
Hi.
Hey. You know, it's that time of year, that part of the year where there's just not a lot going on. Like,
I think that's partially because of the pandemic, because usually this time of year we get like Mobile World Congress, like the After Effects from CES, we'd be getting some product announcements, and there just isn't a ton of gadget news right now.
Totally. I don't know what you're talking about. Nintendo announced today that a five-year-old Legend of Zelda game is coming to Switch.
Oh, that's not even our top story, but you know, that
if it's
that
not Breath of the Wild 2, no thank you. That's what I have to say to Nintendo. Though I am what was the, it's basically a DLC for Mario Odyssey that came out, that's coming out, right? The Donkey, whatever, what's it called?
Kong?
Not yes, I know what Donkey Kong is, but it's I'll look up.
Have
the
you
name.
Guys have? Yeah, I don't think we talked about this last week, but have you guys watched any of the videos coming out of Super Mario World, the theme park at Universal Studios?
Yeah. In Japan? My daughter is crazy about it. Like, she can't wait to get on a plane, and I'm right there with her. It looks amazing. I just worry that they can't possibly handle the number of people that want to go.
I mean, there are people there, plenty of people there now, and there are some really interesting long travel vlogs from Westerners who either live in Japan or are there right now who have been able to go. And we made the conscious decision to watch the video because it was one of those things where it was going to be so long. Like, we didn't do it for Harry Potter. We didn't do it for any of the Star Wars stuff. And while the anticipation certainly is high for us to want to go, and the hope is that it'll come to Orlando as well, and even in Southern California, that's going to be years. We're not going to Japan anytime soon. And the experience can't really be spoiled much of it because, like, the Mario Kart ride has an augmented reality aspect to it. But, you know, we had questions about the logistics of, you know, how big the area actually is based on the maps, what that wristband thing was. And so a lot of that stuff was clarified in some of the videos. I'll include the links to the ones I've watched. You know, they're all very standard travel, like, tourism vlog fare that you see on YouTube. A lot of selfie cams, people being very excited, of course. A couple things I wanted to shout out was the wristband was like their version of the Harry Potter one. You buy the wristband, it allows you to tap blocks and activate lights and, you know, interact with things in the queues. The lines themselves looked like while they're short in the videos, like the Mario Kart line in one of the videos I saw was like 20 minutes long, which seems way too short for what, you know, at full capacity, what it would be. The area that they've designed for the queues seem to be sufficient. It's like a giant, huge, you know, staging area where the attendees waited and decked out. So themed, and like you go through Bowser's library, and all this stuff is sculpted and interactive. And that looks neat. And then the food is probably the thing that I got most hype from watching these videos. Have you seen any of the menu at the restaurants? Oh my gosh. They have like,
is it all eggs? All no, large eggs?
Mushrooms. Hello. Yeah. Fungi. Right. They have like mushroom, pizza pie style thing, things that look like a giant mushroom. They have desserts, tiramisu, that looks like actual, you know, levels of Mario with the green on the grass on the top and layers and a little flagpole at the end. So everything looks super adorable, super cute, and well, super, super Mario.
I think the one thing they should add to this park is an American Ninja Warrior style course that is a Mario level that is super advanced.
With a waiver that you have to sign your life away. I love it.
Yeah, especially when, like, you know, the Venus flytrap thing eats you. But I mean, like, and I don't think they should actually shoot real fireballs at you, but they should make it super hard. And it would be such a spectacle to watch people do that course.
What are you thinking of, like Mario 3 or Super Mario World stuff, things like floors dropping out?
Three.
They're not gonna be able to make blocks disappear. So like what is like, is it the level that has to like forces you to move, right? Is there a wall that pushes you, right? And it can crush you against the side. Like it's, some of those Mario deaths are pretty traumatic.
Just give me a real life series of bridges that are on carousels that go round and round, and let me jump from one to the next, and I'll be very happy, Mario. I would love that.
Platformers, right?
Give me yes, real life platformer. Let me sign my life away instantly, no problem. Skyward Sword came out 10 years ago.
Wow, 2011.
Yeah.
By the way, what I was talking about before was Bowser's Fury, which came out with Super Mario 3D World last week. Mm. And Bowser's Fury, a lot of the reviews are talking about it feels like a Mario Odyssey a DLC in terms of how you interact with it.
It's on my birthday wish list.
So how are things going? What's been new with you guys since last week? Kishore, I know you have moved into a cult, I believe.
Yes, I joined a cult. I'm part of the Peloton family. You will see my hostage video of me celebrating and thanking people for bringing Peloton to my life soon. All joking aside, I really like it so far. I'm only a couple days in, but the people, the instructors are so relentlessly positive in the most negative period that could ever be imagined. It is really refreshing. They're like, I believe in you, Kishore. I think you can overcome this hurdle. And I'm like, no one talks to me like that.
They don't say your name, do they?
No.
Okay. No, they don't say wait. Is this live or are these
to
recorded?
I
have to be honest. Like, I don't know exactly how the tech works. All I know are the memes. SNL did a bit about passive aggressive Peloton instructors. So are these just recordings that you download and play, or is this a live thing?
There's both. There's live classes that, you know, thousands of people participate in together. You know, I think it's upwards of like 10,000 people are in a class together at the same time. And they have pre-recorded ones that you can watch as well. They also have like the scenic rides where you're just in a location and you're just taking a ride, almost like in a, you know, they had like some sort of, you know, 180 rig to kind of document it. It's nice. I don't know if it's nice to have like a little positivity. It is cultish for sure.
If it gets you exercising, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
When you're in the live class, it's a one-to-many, you know, it's an asymmetrical experience. So I'm curious what the interface that the instructor sees. Do they see webcam footage? Is there a webcam? Is there a camera pointed at you?
There is a cam.
So they see like a grid of like a Zoom video of, a, you know, hundreds of potential participants, or they see stats, they see like biometrics. Like, what can they do to affect like your experience?
There's whole blog posts that go over this. They don't see, there's no live camera feed of people, but they can highlight people. They seem to have three screens going. They have a laptop and the screen on their bike. And clearly they can see like a feed that's coming on their screen, a social feed of, you know, who's it's first class, and they give people shout outs, or who has like reached their milestone, like 500th ride or something like that. So they're getting fed by an algorithm that tells them about the people that are kind of enrolled in the class. And then they're getting live sort of views on the program that they're taking people on, like, you know, how fast and all of this kind of stuff. And so they have multiple screens to manage the class. And you can clearly tell, even though there's only the one person running the class, there are support people feeding them information somehow.
Right.
They don't have like an earpiece in, but they have some sort of communication going on with somebody that's recording.
Is it sort of like a Twitch stream or a live YouTube stream where occasionally they will say people's names or respond to some kind of input they're receiving from the viewers?
Yeah, I mean, it's not an input. It's usually just from participation. So you have no way of interacting with them per se, but they will. But it like integrates with Spotify. So the music they play, you can like add to your own Spotify list. Hmm. I have it hooked up to, you know, Strava and all this kind of stuff. What is hilarious to me is, I mean, it's obviously expensive and whatever. It's a worthwhile investment for me since we're in the pandemic period. It's amazing how people have kind of hacked the Peloton experience, because you can get a stationary bike that is Peloton-like for much cheaper, and then add a motion sensor that essentially will allow you to track the cadence, is what they call it in Peloton classes, of how fast your revolutions are. And get like a heart monitor for like a quarter of the price that Peloton's offering for. And you can sign up for the app. So you have the same experience, but you can hack it together. So I actually love the ingenuity of the makers that have kind of hacked the Peloton experience. But overall, it's so about dystopian. The quality of the social experience that makes it worthwhile. God.
One more thing that's become a service, though. That's what rubs me the wrong way.
Exercising's been a service for a long time. It's called the gym.
You know, yeah, that's like, why I won't join it out of principle.
Jime? What's a jime? Oh, a jime. There was that Black Mirror episode from season one or two that was very much this, gamifying the exercise experience to become, to earn your points, to become some type of internet celebrity thing. And this all reminds me of that. It's, I don't know. Who knows? 6 months down the line, we could have one. They're obviously very popular and very successful and have been thriving during the pandemic.
Well, I joined a cult as well. Your cult. I finally watched In and of Itself last night. And I'm sure that our listeners have had their fill, but I have questions. I have comments. So we can do it whenever you want. It can be now. It can be later. It can be off the air. But yeah, I want to catch up with you now that I'm finally one of you.
Wow. Well, let's just do it now.
We can be quick.
Okay.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I was wrecked by it, honestly. I mean, numerous times. But as I reflected on it, I don't want to spoil things for people who haven't seen it yet, but it is in effect like a magic performance, a magic show melded with performance art. Which is something you probably haven't seen before, at least not done like this. And it made me rethink, I have always underestimated the power that magicians can have on storytelling and how good they are at it. Because they're basically, you know, misdirection can be a good part of telling a story, including details, leading you to think a certain way and then flipping the script. That's great movie making. And this has a lot of that to it. And I think it all comes from his mind as a magician. But the part that I was struck by afterwards, like as I started to reflect on it, was that I was so moved by it, but I was moved by a manipulation. I was manipulated to feel that way. You know, I was moved by a magic show. There are tricks at play. I was not moved by, you know, a story that I believed in the same sense that, like, if I was moved by a dramatic film or a book or, you know, a story that you would tell me. And so I guess I was moved by fiction that was trying not to, well, fiction that was ostensibly real, nonfiction. Like the stories that he told were, we were to believe, were nonfiction, were real. And that what the magic that he played out, the magic tricks that he performed, we were to believe were real. And that's why they were amazing. You know, if you start to dissect a magic show, which is fun, and that's what I really want to do about this show, is like talk to you guys about how these tricks were done. You know, it's a different experience. But like, it's just the idea that a magic show would affect you on an emotional level is astounding. Like, that's an incredible achievement. But, like, how... should, like, how did you guys feel about being affected that way by a magic show? Were you conflicted about that?
I think you're getting hung up on the fact that the format was a magic show, in which deception and manipulation are part of the tricks at play,
mm-hmm. Right?
And that's part of every storytelling, right? In the way the analogy of a filmmaker or a writer, and I think that the truth of the story is interwound with the events that he describes. And I think there's plenty of truth there in terms of the events actually happening. Like, he bears like real parts of his soul and real parts of his life in mm-hmm. this, because it is part one man show as well as magic show. But the emotional truth is very true. And what he's able to elicit in the audience, not only in person, but also, I think, successfully in the viewing audience at home, which I think is even harder to do when you're not one of 80 people in that room over the span of a year watching the show. Like, that that emotional truth, I ask you, did you feel truth in your feelings? Or did you feel it was just strings being pulled? Like, did it make you introspective in a way that the audience member sitting?
Yes. I loved hearing the story about his childhood and with his mom and what he grew up with in terms of like trying to foster friendships. But, and that was all very real. And I grant you that, like, that is authentic, and that's great. But the part that I reflected on was like, there's other parts of the show which are clearly just illusions. They are tricks. And yet they are tricks that cause most of the audience and me to go to tears. What? Like, we should only be crying if it's authentic. Like, that's crazy. That to me is
I think he's augmenting a true emotion, right? There, again, we won't go into spoilers, but there's an important part of the show where he transforms an audience member on stage. You watch them transform.
Right.
And the power of that transformation, is manufactured, right? Because it is a trick thing.
Yes.
Right? He knows he's going to succeed. Like, it's part of the act, but the core of the transformation itself, however manufactured, is born out of the root of it. The seed of it is real emotion. Right, it's not a plant. You know, if it was if the audience member on the stage, and I think there's been one of the reactions from people watching the show is there are plants on them, and it's a tried and true technique in magic tricks that you have audience member who are part of the show who are performers as well. Yeah. That is not the case here, and the transformation happens is a true transformation, even though work was done ahead of time to make that happen.
I can't imagine any way that is not a plant. Have you confirmed that? Do you know anybody who was that
person?
So
you didn't
listen
to our podcast. Yes, Danica was that person.
She was the one who was transformed?
Yes.
You're kidding me.
I am not kidding you.
In New York City?
Yes.
Wow. What was what card did she have? I am what?
Philatelist.
What is that?
As a stamp collector.
Wow. And so she went up there and
I don't want to go too much into spoil. Maybe we could take this offline, okay. Jeremy. But wrestle with that.
Okay, well in the film, and I assume in many performances, the person who is transformed is confounded, like completely befuddled,
yes.
Confused. How is this possible?
Yes.
And that was, is that how she felt?
Yes. She didn't make the cut in the film. We were waiting for her to make, she signed a release afterward to make the documentary. Yeah. She didn't make the cut because she was so, I don't want to speak too much for her, but her reaction was so, so much of incredulity that like she didn't burst into tears because I think she was holding, like, she was being too logical about the whole thing.
All right, I got to ask you more about this offline, because that's incredible. I'm glad you have inside information on this. But incredible show, no matter how you look at it. I do, like I said, I do feel a little bit odd having been so affected by something that is an illusion. But you could say that about any work of fiction, I suppose. It's just that most works of fiction, you know that they're fiction. And this, or this is ostensibly nonfiction. That's the part that I'm confused by.
If you take the word magic out of the show, and it's a one-man show, that there's some audience involvement, I think it's the same show. It's still affecting. And then, you know, it takes away the sense that it was... I think what the focus is that it was special. It, like, created some, like, real alchemy that night. And with those that you watch it with. And that's the point of the show. It's a meditation on identity that you can only have in the way that it was architected. And yes, you're manipulated, but all theater does that. All theater is a manipulation in a way.
Yeah, that's fair.
I'll give a shout out, and I'm kind of bleeding into the pop culture section right now. Empire magazine over in the UK, it's one of the last big film magazines, but they did a big special issue last month that was curated by Edgar Wright, and the whole issue was about the celebration of what it means to watch a movie in a theater with audience, with other audience members, you know, whether it's five other people in the audience or a full packed GM theater on opening night. But it's interviews with filmmakers, actors, writers, other people who've been in the film business about what makes the theatrical experience special. And it is a, I mean, we can even describe it. It's something that we've certainly talked about on this podcast, but it's different for everyone. But there's undeniably an energy and undeniably a value to the physical presence of being in a theater for a live show or a film. I think what Derek Delgadio did with In and of Itself was able to create something special, like Shore's point, that shared with those 80 people every single night. The final trick that he does, the climax of the show, binds the audience, binds those 80 people in the shared experience that's unlike anything I'd ever experienced before. And then they successfully took this culmination of every one of those performances and edited it in a linear film across and distributed on Hulu that somehow connected people watching it at home. And I think that's a magical thing that they did.
What do you mean connected with people at home?
Like the power to have the emotional truth that he pulled out of that last trick.
Yeah.
And it's tough to talk about without going into spoilers, but like what that, I think he did that successfully every night. The fact that was able to be relayed to someone who, like you or Will, who just watched it at home and to feel something, that shared feeling of something. I've seen that people talk about how that's affected them on social media since this film came out. And that's a profound thing, I think.
Did it remind you guys of Soul? Or I guess in retrospect, did Soul remind you of this show? Because you would have seen this show first. They seem like they have some similar themes.
I mean, only in that it sought to bring out some emotional truth in a story that allowed you to maybe be reflective in a way,
but very much about identity and how other people define you and how you define yourself.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. I mean, those are the dominant themes in both those pieces. Absolutely, yeah. It makes me very excited for his upcoming book. Derek Delgadio has a book called A Moral Man, but maybe just one word together. And it's coming out, I think, beginning of March. I just pre-ordered it on Amazon. I'll include a link to that in the show notes as well. But I'm glad you enjoyed the show.
Oh, I'm glad. No, I wanted to thank you for encouraging me to watch it, because I probably wouldn't have had you not. And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the show a lot. I wish so much that I could have seen it. But, you know, I'm grateful that they made it into a show you can watch on Hulu.com.
All right, let's move on to, finally, our top story.
Story this week.
As you're listening to this, it may be Thursday, and depending on what time on Thursday, things might be afoot on another world. We have many Mars landings happening today. We talked about this briefly 2 weeks ago, but for those of us in the States, we've been following NASA's deployment of Perseverance, which hopefully by the time you listen to this on mid-Thursday, around what, 1 p.m. Pacific time, is that right, Kishore? It will have landed on Mars.
So NASA begins its live stream at 11:15 a.m. Pacific time on Thursday. Descent will start soon thereafter, a little after noontime. And what we're going to happen is the vehicle is going to hit the atmosphere, pretty quickly slow down, and it hits its like deceleration within, you know, a peak deceleration within minutes. And then a parachute deploys, which, you know, essentially will go taut, like it'll inflate, as it were, within a second of it being deployed, and sort of gently start to lower this towards the Martian surface. It's still going a couple hundred miles an hour, I think, while it's on this descent. It during this time, it jettisons a heat shield, and then the bottom of the rover essentially starts to activate, where cameras and radar activate that'll autonomously guide it to a location within Jezero Crater to land. It will fire rockets to kind of for the final 2 kilometers for this powered descent, and then the sky crane takes over within 20 meters of the surface, like gently lowering it down until it touches down. A lot of similarities to the 7 minutes of terror for the Curiosity landing. The big difference is that Jezero Crater has a ton of boulders in it, because it's the site of a former lake on Mars. And so this is our chance to sort of drill in and look for signs of previous life on the planet. And so this is a much more tricky technical landing, and the rover is doing quite a bit of that heavy lifting. It'll land, and then there's a 12-minute delay between it communicating back to Earth because of the speed of light. So we'll get confirmation around 12:55, around thereabouts Pacific time, of its successful landing or not. You know, there's a lot of missions to Mars, you know, upwards of half that have been failures in the past. So this isn't a foregone conclusion that everything's going to go great. But the track record recently has been awesome. I am definitely tuning into this live stream. If you can remember where you were when Curiosity landed, seeing our friend Bobek in the room and Adam Stelter and that whole crew, and how they erupted in celebration. The one white guy that, you know, started dancing joyously when they got confirmation. We're in a very similar situation here. And it's at a time that most of the U.S. is going to be wide awake and ready to able to watch this. It's a historic moment. I can't wait.
And it's not even the only of the Mars landers or the Mars vehicles and that are headed there because of the optimal launch window. But yeah, you guys remember where you were when Curiosity was landing last time? It was in August, right? August, like it was an evening. What was it, 2012 or so? I remember the footage. I remember all the hype and the animations with that 7 minutes of terror. And I think we talked about how, you know, NASA, obviously priority one is landing the rover, but the tech has come so far, and they have now ways, hopefully, of documenting that very exciting part of the landing. Oh, we want this to be a regular thing, but it is. It's going to be nerve-wracking.
It's never going to be a regular thing. Like, it's just like every time I watch a SpaceX launch and watch a rocket land on a barge in the middle of the ocean. I'm never not going to be excited about this.
May that always be the case. I mean, the problem is that people do historically lose interest in these things. That's why we stopped going to the moon, for instance. Like, it just, after the Apollo missions, the you know, the public just decided, no, thank you. I've seen this before, and now that we got these guys home safe, that's enough.
Well, to be fair, though, the scientific impetus to go to the moon was lessened we're in a very different situation with Mars right now. And the length of travel, this isn't the moon. This is another planet. And the potential here to find signs of life on another planet, this is the closest chance, statistically, that we're going to get to it, given what was in Jezero Crater. So I can't help but be just around the solar system excited for this tomorrow. And I think everyone should tune in. I actually might stream and just do like my reactions to it because this is just monumental. I we're at a point right now where the first human to walk on Mars is alive. Somewhere on this planet is alive.
That's crazy. That person. That's a perspective.
Wow.
It could be Avery. No. Would you allow your children if they wanted to be the first person?
You realize Mars? If your child were eligible, you would not be in charge of them anymore.
If you knew now, you could still affect the path of the future to change that path. I don't know. That's a dad question if there ever was one.
Last note on Perseverance, the real exciting day in terms of the confirmation, if everything goes well, Friday, we're actually going to see footage of the descent and the landing. So Friday is the day to kind of mark to keep an eye out on NASA social for the first images from Mars from this landing. And I think it's just going to be super cool. We're going to have an actual insight into the 7 minutes of terror. And video, as I mentioned before, it's going to be a series of still images is what it's going to look like of that experience.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I think of not only the camera technology that's gotten better and also, the relays for data to come back from Mars, but also computer processing technology to interpolate the images and create, not just colorized images. Now there will be real color, but all that raw data being visualized in really cool ways back here. Lots of cool stuff.
Are the signals relayed from an orbiting satellite around Mars?
Yeah, and everything comes through the Deep Sky Network, which routes through JPL. So,
All right, let's move on to pop culture. Shall we begin with some WandaVision talk, my friends? Our weekly catch-up. We are now 6 episodes in. Is that right? Only 3 left, and the 3 final episodes, I think, are reported to be much longer episodes. But the format absolutely has shifted. Jeremy, you weren't here last week as we talked about a major, major developments, one of the biggest episodes so far, but things seem to be shaken up even more. So a little bit of a recap, of course, if you've been following WandaVision, every episode so far, except for one of them, has taken on a version of a sitcom from the 20th century. And this most recent episode moves into the aughts. So maybe the late 90s, early aughts. It's kind of tough to
It's track. 90s.
Like, is it 90s? Yeah, maybe late 90s. Maybe this will age us. When I saw it, I saw Malcolm in the Middle. When you guys saw it, did you see Alf or Malcolm in the Middle?
Malcolm in the Middle. 100%.
I have not watched it yet, but I was hoping to see Malcolm in the Middle, so it's interesting that you say that.
It wasn't one I predicted. I thought they could have gone Friends. There are so many 90s era sitcoms that, household sitcoms, they didn't really go Full House on one of them, and there's 80s episode, kind of a little bit more but yeah, they went full like VHS is how I would describe it, with the opening, the hair, and if you didn't see the episode, Jeremy, I don't know if we should dive too much into it, but maybe just some reactions then, Kishore.
I think every cosplayer is going to be going as that version of the Vision next time there's a con. It was awesome to see this was the most comic booky of the episodes, there were so many callbacks to outfits and, you know, sort of jokes and tie-ins to the comic books, which I liked. The kind of horror show element that has been underneath this show for weeks is really starting to come to the fore. And it's becoming very, very sinister very quickly. And I don't know what else to say except the kind of ending. I was like, oh, there's some ramifications with just what just happened now. There's going to be some big ramifications. And I couldn't be more excited about the first couple minutes of the next episode, given where our friends Monica ended up.
Our Not just Monica, Jimmy Woo, and Darcy, where they ended
well,
up.
Well, Darcy, yeah, but yeah.
I will turn on spoilight for one thing. This maybe won't be a big. This will be a thing for you to look out because I'm not sure it's a thing you'll catch, Jeremy.
Oh, but give me some credit.
This is more less a comic book thing, but at the end of the episode, one of our heroes goes back into the zone, right? The hex, as it's called. And as characters go into the hex, they maybe get transformed. And Darcy ends up engulfed in the hex at the end of this episode. And so my honest hope is that this next episode, this Friday's episode, will be a riff off of Two Broke Girls.
Oh.
With her reprising her sitcom, having actually been in a sitcom in this past 10 years. But I still think the show needs to pay off why the sitcom format. What is it about this format? Why has in this reality bending nexus has Wanda created, has replicated pop culture from America in the 20th century?
Can't that go unsaid? I mean, we could imagine reasons why. You know, it's the Walt Disney white picket fence neighborhood. It's what Wanda wanted to have with the Vision and can't. And so now that's the fantasy, you know, and it is as stilted and unrealistic as, you know, as it should be, because it's all made up.
I think Norm's right. It has to pay off narratively somehow. Otherwise, it's going to feel like a gimmick in retrospect. And it could be as simple as, like, that's how she learned English, is watching sitcoms over the years. You know, it could be something hokey like that. But I do think they need to explain it a little bit. I think they have a lot of work to do in three episodes around the sinister nature of what's going on, the brother, all this kind of stuff needs to get tied up somewhat. They don't need to explain, you know, some of the multiverse stuff that seems to be happening, because that will set up future shows, but they need to pay off some stuff.
I think the fan prediction, the community prediction that there's some additional malevolent force in the form of a devil-like character, I think that's too far-fetched for the scope of the MCU, and I think it'll be too weird to throw in at this last in the last three episodes.
There's got to be some sort of villainous force, though, that is alluded to, because it doesn't. Otherwise, I don't think this will pay off fully.
You guys have a lot
of
requirements.
I send Norm like a weekly now prediction of something crazy that's going to happen in this show.
It's crazy.
So I have a really crazy one that is out there. That if it happens, you'll owe me a Coke for sure.
I'll give you my Batu Coke that I still have at the tested office on the shelf behind our podcast table.
Should have bet a Coke on Han Solo coming back for the last
Star
Wars
movie.
Oh my
God. That, what an off the cuff remark that ended up to be true. Oh, Kishore and his predictions. All right. Spoilers off. We'll dive deeper into it next week. Two other bits of pop culture news. Big news in the video game world. We have finally the casting of the characters, the lead roles in The Last of Us HBO show. Of course, it's a beloved two-game franchise. Last of Us 2 winning all the Game of the Year awards last year from Naughty Dog on the PlayStation platform. But Last of Us 1, I don't know what they're going to adapt from. But Craig Mazin, who did Chernobyl, who's the creator and writer of Chernobyl miniseries on HBO, is the co-writer. And I think Neil Druckmann from Naughty Dog is the other co-writer as well. But they've casted Pedro Pascal in the lead role as Joel. I don't know if either of you played The Last of Us games, but Pedro Pascal being someone shepherding a child across a post-war wasteland seems to be a thing now. I mean, his paternal role in The Mandalorian has kind of bridged to this character portrayal. It's a very different character, but I think I like it. It wasn't something that was on the fan casting minds. A lot of people had hoped for maybe, what's the guy's name? Jamie from Game of Thrones.
Oh, or Nick Costawalder.
Yes, whatever. Yes. Logan was very much in this. The Wolverine movie, the last Wolverine movie, was very much in that same vein. It's the road, right? It's a classic story of post-apocalyptic world where an adult and a child have to make their way through it, and they form a bond, and the world affects them as much as they affect each other in survival. This shows me super exciting. It's going to be probably very, very bleak. The game is very bleak, so it's something we're all looking forward to. And then the girl in the role, Ellie, is being played by Bella Ramsey, who is also in Game of Thrones. She played Mormont, Lady Mormont, in the last season, and she was really good in that portrayal. Last bit, Tim Burton is doing his first television show on Netflix, going a little bit back to the well with a Wednesday Addams live action show set in the modern day. This is the Addams family, but a young Wednesday Addams. I guess she's young in the movie already, but being some type of detective, occult investigator, maybe in the vein of a Sabrina or the CW shows, but Tim Burton bring his aesthetic and directorial capabilities to Netflix. Yeah.
Who's going to play Wednesday?
They have not announced that yet.
Can somebody talk to Tim Burton about like this gothic phase that he's been in for like 40 years?
I don't
How
think
long
you can
has
call
it, been?
It a phase. I think it's an
it's
identity.
It's not a phase. It is a little bit too one note. I was like, what's the character that Tim Burton, a stereotypical Tim Burton would get into? Wednesday Addams is like high on that list. This is ridiculous. Sorry, yeah. I'm not hyped for this.
The Addams Family is right there next to Edward Scissorhands and Beetlejuice, just kind of like in the time period. So you're right.
He was on a huge role in the 80s. I mean, the biggest movie in the world was Batman in 1989. He was the biggest director in the world, and he followed that up while doing Batman Returns. He also produced Nightmare Before Christmas. So what a string of hits. But yeah, I mean, he's had a few, I think, critical successes in explorations in weirder films like Big Eyes he did. Mm-hmm. But, things like his blockbuster films haven't done so well. The Johnny Depp one he did, Dark Shadows, his Planet of the Apes was hugely hyped, but ultimately, I think, disappointing. And then he did the Alice in Wonderland film, which made $1 billion. But,
did it?
Creatively, yeah, it made a billion dollars. But, the kid likes it. But, yeah, it doesn't stand the test of time, I think. Not as much as the original. Interesting fact. I think, this is maybe apocryphal, but did you know that Beetlejuice, the studio did not like the name Beetlejuice and wanted Tim Burton to change it. And he offered as a joke to change the movie's name to Scared Sheetless, which was a intentional
Much
bad
worse.
Name. And the studio wanted that name. They thought it was clever and they wanted that name. And it was a fight for them to keep the Beetlejuice name. There goes your bit of movie trivia for the week. All right, let's move on to tech news.
And I love you.
As we said at the top of the show, Nintendo had their Nintendo Direct just earlier, just like an hour before we start recording. People were holding their breath for Breath of the Wild 2. No, the game, which is they announced 2 years ago now, pre-pandemic announcement. I think we saw like the first glimpse of that, or maybe some more characters for Super Smash Brothers. You know, there were jokes about bringing Paddington to Super Smash Brothers, but turns out there was some Zelda news, but it was not the news we've been hoping for. Instead, the 2011 game Skyward Sword is getting an HD remaster for the Switch. Was this the first one on the Wii?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. No. No, it wasn't. No.
Yes.
No.
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 Because this game was on the Wii, but I can't remember if there's another Zelda game on it before that.
Well, I confirmed it came out in 2001. So
no, 2011.
2011. Sorry, there was a 2000-something one. So yes, 2011.
Twilight Princess was afterward. No, Twilight Princess was 2006. That was the first one. Twilight Princess, 2006. Skyward Sword, 2011.
So which is the one where you were on a floating island and then you flew down to the world below? Was that this one? Was that Skyward Sword?
I don't think I've ever played Skyward Sword.
I think that must be it then, because you look very confused.
Yeah,
being on a floating island.
Maybe this is the one that I'll play.
I don't know, dude. I'm sure that all Zelda games are great on some level, but this is one that I never got into. I couldn't get past like the first act.
Well, how long until we get Breath of the Wild 2 is the question.
It can't be long. It has to be within the next year,
dude.
It'll be within the next year.
Breath of the Wild is a once in a generation game. Like the amount of brute force it took to make that game is unbelievable. It's like
what do you mean by brute force? The sheer amount of like content?
Development hours. Yes, okay. Development hours, man hours, woman hours, you know, art, assets, design, like from the geometry to the textures to the level design to the quest design. It's like an incredible achievement. It's like a massively multiplayer online game for a single player. And I don't imagine that the sequel will be anywhere near the impact, will have the impact that the first game had, but I will play it. It is my favorite game.
It's undeniably, the scope is massive. And development for Breath of the Wild, according to Wikipedia, was 5 years. The game came out in 2017, so it's going to be, come March, it will be 4 years since the game's release. But I'm sure much of that development wasn't just asset building. It was the perfecting of the game design. And if Breath of the Wild 2 takes the same approach, it being a sequel in terms of the style of gameplay, they've solved much of that. Yes, they're going to want to innovate in some other ways, but if you're just talking about pure level mission creation, voice recording, animation, asset creation, you know, there's no reason why Breath of the Wild 2 couldn't be just as large in scope. And I think
that those two things were happening in tandem, and that there was 5 years worth of, you know, asset development. And so, but it has been a while since Breath of the Wild came out. You know, it has been years.
It's been 2 years since the trailer for Breath of the Wild 2 came out. So that's, I mean, I will be as patient as I need to be for Breath of the Wild 2. But when you saw the trailer, you're like, okay, maybe we're a year and a half, 2 years away from this. It's been 2 years. So that's why I was thinking, you know, I think it'll come out this year, actually. I think most people think it's going to be early next year. But there's so much to tell with Ganondorf waking up. Like, I mean, that's such a massive story. So I think the game will be bigger. I think they're probably perfecting some of the mechanics, because there's going to be some new fighting mechanics for Link that they're going to have to make available somehow.
You know, and the, what was it, Twilight Princess, the first Wii Zelda, was one that bridged the console generation, right? It was out on both GameCube and Wii, And so the question is for Breath of the Wild, you know, there's so many people have Switches now. Obviously, you want to make it compatible with everyone that has a Switch now. But if the rumors bear true that they're working on some type of Switch Pro, could it be that extra development time would make it take advantage of whatever rendering capabilities that you might get on the Switch Pro
right.
to sell new hardware?
Breath of the Wild was also a game that bridged generations because it was on the Wii U.
Oh, was it also?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez. It was also on Switch, and the Switch was the superior version.
Yeah, yeah.
I was secretly hoping if they were going to announce a game, I actually really liked Wind Walker, even though it's like a totally different art style. That game was fun. So I actually was hoping they would do a remaster of that.
Didn't they already do that?
Did they?
Wind Waker? Yeah, Wind Waker
I believe
HD.
So.
Yeah, yes.
You're in luck.
When did that come out?
Available now.
There you go. They redid it for Wii U.
Oh.
Because this is the 1080p resolution.
Well, I hope everyone's enjoying this discovery of things that came out 10 years ago.
This is what COVID has done to us. Speaking of things that came out decades ago, GTA 3 finding new life because industrious coders and hackers have found a way, and I don't understand how this works, to reverse engineer the raw source code of GTA 3. How do I haven't done any programming outside of like AP classes in high school, so and some light stuff in college, but my understanding is when you compile code, it goes in one direction. Like information is lost for when you create the exe, that you can't just go back to the source code. How do you reverse engineer assets to code?
I wish I could tell you. This is an amazing thing that we should get somebody on here who knows what they're talking about, because I'm sure there's a really cool story to be told. I know nothing. I know that there are decompilers that can take, you know, compiled code and reverse it into, you know, some sort of readable, probably like assembly language, which is what your compiler, when you're writing C++, will convert it to. And then, you know, that's basically your machine code. But it's not going to have any comments. It's going to be a jumbled mess. You're not going to have the structure, organization, stuff like that. So the fact that they did this on any level is amazing. Of course, like, how old is Grand Theft Auto? It's over 10 years old. It's this has taken a while, and it's the kind of thing that you would expect from a game that is now, you know, showing its age like this. But it's it's awesome. It's awesome, and I love all the implications of what this has in terms of porting to new platforms. There's a lot of people who'd love to see it in VR. Obviously, it would take not just a matter of compiling it. You'd have to change so much about the gameplay in order to make it work in stereo and not cause motion sickness. But it's all possible now, and it's exciting. It's a great game to this day.
Yeah, possible improvements that they listed include, you know, not only bug fixes, but reduced loading times, improved rendering, widescreen support, free floating camera systems, which I guess when you have that kind of free floating camera, that's how you would get that type of VR support, by having multiple camera, multiple views to render, and then also porting to Linux and Switch and even other platforms, aside from, of course, the assets. So much like, you know, when we talk about the Doom 3 VR port, you'd have to buy the game, get the assets. But then in that case, the source code was actually publicly release versus backward engineered. Xbox recently, Microsoft just announced a boost mode for their Series X. I still don't have a Series X or S, but this is one of those things that's like only happens in consoles. You know, when you see a console generation get updated and there's backward compatibility and it's emulated, you don't actually always get all the benefits of the hardware that you would get on with faster hardware, like you would on a PC, just by upgrading your graphics card. But this is a new mode called FPS Boost, and for compatible games such as Far Cry 4 and Watch Dogs 2, you get up to twice the frame rate, up to 120 FPS in some instances. And you toggle it just like you would toggle on something like HDR.
It's like my 486 had a turbo button.
Oh my god! Yeah. It was an actual physical button on the chassis that was tied to a jumper on a motherboard or something, and a light would turn on. But what did that do? What did the turbo button actually do?
It doubled the clock speed of the CPU from 33 megahertz to 66 megahertz.
And why wouldn't the CPU run just at 66 megahertz?
It would if the turbo button is pressed in, but that would be too fast for many, many programs, games that were written to use every ounce of power that a 386 or a lower 486 could turn out.
So it was a problem with the coding. It was the games did not anticipate the faster rendering and didn't artificially lock themselves to frame rate or some type of cycles. And so you'd want to run it, emulate it, or in that case, run it on what would then be older hardware. Wow, what a problem to have. Yeah. I mean, also, it's like the equivalent of when I was growing up, the era of running Quake demo files, which you would run at however fast the frame rate could be cranked out. So you'd run it as a benchmark test where you'd run replay files on a Quake 2 or Quake 3, deathmatch game that was recorded, and it wouldn't get locked to 30 FPS in real time. It would just play. And so if your graphics card was new enough or fast enough, it would play at 4 or 5x speed, and you crank out and it'd show you your resulting FPS at the bottom.
Yes, yeah. We are old.
Jeremy, let's move on to some car stuff. You are one of the proud owners of an original Chevy Bolt.
I was the first to drive it off the Chevy lot, man. I was the first person to buy one in San Francisco.
You and Waz, right? You and Waz were the two in the Bay Area.
Yeah, it's hard to keep track of all the things we have in common. But that's up there.
The Volt is long gone, right? The hybrid electric car and the Bolt, the all-electric one, had been chugging along, so to speak. But now, come next year, Chevy is going to revamp the Bolt with not only updated speeds and feeds, but it's now a hatchback. The form factor gone.
It was always a hatch. It's the same car. They tried to call it a crossover. Initially, but it's the same thing. There's two now. That's the thing. There's two bolts now. Yeah. So there's the same old Bolt, and it's a new look, and it has a new interior design, better seats, which from day one, that's been the biggest complaint about from Bolt owners. Seats uncomfortable for many people. New seats. That's great. But they have a whole new Bolt now that they're calling the EUV. That is essentially the same car. I don't understand it. It is the same platform. It's the same motor, the same drivetrain. Everything about it is the exact same. It has a slightly different body. It's 6 inches longer. There's a little more leg room. And in this car, you can get the option of level 2 self-driving, which they're calling Chevy Super Cruise. And you can't get that on the new Bolt, even though they're both they're both essentially like new models. So it's very strange. I'm not sure why they're making this second model. It seems like a lot of work because there is no practical difference between the two cars. You can't get an all-wheel drive version of the EUV. It's still two-wheel drive. Same range. Very strange.
But the EUV is way more expensive, presumably.
It's like $3,000 more expensive. It's not much more expensive. And
this says
there is actually more cargo space in the Bolt than there is in the longer car. It's an odd thing. I'm not sure what to make of it. I'm mostly disappointed because I was thinking of trading in my car. I'm on my fifth year of my Bolt. I was thinking of trading it in this year for the new one if there was a level 2 self-driving option. And there isn't. You have to get this, what I think is like even worse looking EUV version of the car. So I'm opening my eyes to what else is out there. I actually asked on Twitter. There's an enormous number of people who have their eyes on the new ID4.
I don't know about this.
Yeah, it's a Volkswagen.
Yeah, that's the Volkswagen. Yeah,
it's the first Volkswagen all electric car, and it was like I think it's out in Germany and England first. They have a lot of reviews there. Surfaced as of like 2 months ago, but it's coming here this year. The first round is like sold out, but you can get in line for one later this year. But it's got level 2 self-driving. It's got an amazing array of technology that I haven't seen in any from anybody else, including a HUD system that is like beyond what other people have done. It actually has a three-dimensional HUD where it will project GPS directions on the road in front of you, and they will start in the distance and they will come closer to you, and they'll
parallax. You'll get some type because of the screen that it's projecting on.
Yeah, and they will highlight cars in front of you and like say put a little line beneath them, and it will motion track them, and it will say this is the car that like adaptive cruise control is tracking right now. It's crazy space age. It has a light, like an LED strip that goes along the entire front of the car beneath where the windshield meets the like the dashboard, and that entire LED strip is used to like indicate turning directions and like alerts. It's super cool. Like I just love technology and cars, and this is loaded with new stuff. So I'm now looking at the ID4, but the new Bolt stuff. Whatever. It's it's underwhelming. When the Bolt came out 4 years ago, it was the only car besides a Tesla that had the 250 mile range, 230 plus mile range. But now there's so many more options.
Yeah. And both the ID4 and the new Bolt have up to 250 freeway range, which you'll fall short of what the Model S or the Model 3 and the Y offer at a little above 300. But I think that's still a good, it passes that test of like, will this get you past a week of driving? And you as an electric car owner and me as an electric car owner, we know that we're not treating recharging the car in the same way that you do filling up the gas, where you do it only when it's empty. You're plugging in almost like a phone or a laptop, where you just want to, if you can, you leave it plugged in, and that keeps the battery healthy, and you let the software regulate.
And the big difference, though, is the Bolt doesn't have any of the federal tax credit available. The ID4 potentially does. And that all of a sudden makes them almost the same price.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because the Bolt did lower the price. Like for the regular Bolt, it's now $5,000 less expensive than the 2021 model. And that's because they ran out of tax credits, and now they're just basically building the credit into the price.
It's so funny that $30,000 and the ID4 is like 40. So you take that tax credit off, you're pretty close.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all good stuff as more and more car manufacturers commit to moving their fleets to EV, EV only in certain parts of the world in the next two decades, decade and a half even. But it's so interesting to see these older car companies, I say older, more established car companies treat their cars more like, the consumer electronics devices that people are buying on the regular basis, in terms of paying a lot of attention to the infotainment systems and not just the driving experience, which is an important thing, and they need to get that right. Driving experience and battery capacities and a match with price is going to get what gets a person who previously was not interested in EV interested, because if they can figure it for the same price, there's no premium, they're going to get they're going to save money on the gas, and they can get enough usage out of it to get them through a week of driving. But it's the differentiators are going to be like that crazy interface that you talked about, and that's just a lot of this user experience stuff that we're all still in like this new frontier of because of self-driving. And I'm so glad there are going to be more options out there so that we aren't locked down into the uniformity of just the Tesla interface or whatever Apple decides to do for their car's interface. Because, it's frankly, those are kind of boring. They're functional, but, there's so much innovation that can happen with the differentiation in UI and UX in the driver's seat.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing I really do like about the Tesla is every other car manufacturer, you're basically locked into the interface that you get when you buy the car. And Tesla is open to over-the-air software updates as much as the platform that's in the car can support, ongoing. So you've seen changes since you've owned your car, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And recently in the past 2 months, they did a huge graphical overhaul change. And I'm of two minds about it. Because, for me, I welcome it because I want to see the updates, and it's better than the old way of doing things. 20 years ago, a Toyota, if you want the new interface, you got to buy the new car, right? That was one of the ways they would differentiate. If you want the new maps, you have to buy the new car. So you get the new DVDs inside your dash to give you the new maps. OTA updates make the cars more like consumer devices, electronics devices that we're accustomed to in today's day and age, but they come with the pitfalls of compatibility of, like, you know, it's like iOS, running iOS on older hardware. You know, how do they balance optimizations for making it run smooth across four different generations of cars? Where does support end? And for a layperson who, like my parents, you know, they may get confused if they suddenly turn their car and yes, they accept the software update, or they turn on the software update on their phone. But if they get in their car and suddenly the thing that they expected to be in one place for making a phone call or opening the glove box isn't where they expected to be, that learning curve isn't something that people are traditionally used to for a car, right? Where you things, there's muscle memory in where you want to get access to things. I'm fine with it as someone who, you know, who likes the cutting edge, but I've noticed performance hiccups in the Tesla for sure, where I'm sure it runs really great on someone buying a car today and the new models with their new processors. But, you know, sometimes it takes a while for the radio to boot up. I'm serious. Yeah. It's like I have, you know, a 3-year-old iPhone hardware with the newest version of iOS.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wish the Tesla would support CarPlay, on a side note, just because I feel like then it's really just a projection system, but whatever. That's I know I'm not alone in wishing they would do that, but there's no one telling Elon Musk what to do.
No, not when he's made more money on Bitcoin than on Tesla. All right, let's skip science because we talked at the top of the show, but move on to the VR Minute.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
Last week, you mentioned the Oculus App Lab went live, a great way for developers to release software without having going through the certification process. But to browse for that, you actually have to either developers share the link so you can upload it to your headset, or you can get SideQuest. And SideQuest now has the App Lab support, so you have a whole directory of those apps. Some experiments we've seen kind of developers, you know, talk here and there about things that we've actually seen on SideQuest before. The question mark, though, is will virtual desktop wireless streaming be an App Lab-enabled feature?
Is that still in limbo?
I think it, as of right now, last I heard, still in limbo, has not been confirmed.
Yeah,
that would be a thing.
Boz did say, though, publicly, he said, you know, the reason why that's still a question for us is because we can't control the quality of the user's Wi-Fi at home, and we want to make sure that they have a comfortable, good experience. I mean, isn't the whole point of App Lab, like, you don't have complete control over the user experience, and, like, right. they may get uncomfortable?
And they're okay with that. And
exactly.
Users are, yeah. Okay. It's not going to affect the broader, you know, people aren't going to complain on social media about bad Oculus experiences because they set up a wireless Wi-Fi connection, you know, and didn't get the best quality of experience. Yeah, it's buyer beware there.
You don't have to go into SideQuest, by the way, to see their list of apps. You can go to applabdb.com.
Mm.
I believe SideQuest set this up. They definitely... they have a site. I think this is it. There's a couple people who are running these third-party, you know, aggregators of all the games that are on App Lab, and this is a good one. You can sort by popularity, new rating, or the price, and it's, you know, links directly into the store. The problem, as you said, is Oculus doesn't have a way to browse
directory.
The games that are in there. Right. You can search the store for the exact title if you want to see it in the Oculus store, but there's no way to browse them. But this is a way to do it. AppLabDB.com. I've been enjoying browsing that and see what new apps are on there. And there's a lot. They've already approved a lot of games.
And then going back to old games, classic games, System Shock 2 is getting the classic PC cyber thriller game, horror game. It's getting a enhanced mode from Night Dive Studios. And they also confirmed that they're going to get a VR mode for System Shock 2. I think it's a great idea.
Were you a PC gamer when that came out?
Oh, System Shock 2?
Yeah.
I think I might have just been a subscriber, but that was like one of the...
It was big.
Hugely regarded, right? Terrifying game.
I think Billy Harms played it. He must have reviewed it because he was playing it constantly in the office. And I remember him having to take breaks. Like, it was just scary. He's like, oh my God, the monkeys are coming after me. That was a game that I respected and wanted to enjoy, but the slowness of the RPG aspect kept me from enjoying it too much. It's the perfect game for me to revisit in VR, because I'll be more immersed and I'll enjoy those RPG aspects more, I suspect.
And it was the precursor to Deus Ex. Like, Deus Ex was the spiritual successor to that type of game. Right. It also reminds me so much of the Alien Isolation, you know, VR mod, right? All those, the VR horror games, that being a really engrossing VR port. Night Dive, the studio is working on the enhanced edition, said that the VR version will be built from the ground up. So motion control support. I don't think it's going to come out the same time as the enhanced version. That might be later. But there will be co-op. So Jeremy, co-op
what?
For this game, it might be the way to go.
And
co-op for VR will be cross-platform, where one person can be in VR, another person can be on flat screen. So I'm all for it. I'm all for these co-op asymmetrical VR experiences, all for classic games with the assets being either upgraded or building in motion control support. Yeah, more of that, please.
Yes, please.
And that will do it for our show this week. Anything you guys want to promote or shout out while I pick an outro?
Do you guys feel like I was too hard on In and of Itself? Do you guys
hard?
Yeah, do you guys? No. I didn't feel like you guys like really like.
Your review started with "I liked it." That's not a hard review.
I loved it. I just feel like you guys like didn't like totally get what I was saying. Like you weren't whatever.
No, I actually really get it. I because there's a lot of people in the audience at the show that I went to that night that were in a similar state of mind, was talking about like the magic and the tricks as opposed to thinking about it through the lens of like the theater and the experience. So
yeah,
I think that's pretty common.
As a fellow Vulcan, I relate to your skepticism.
Yeah. The only thing I have to say is perseverance. This is twice in a lifetime for us. Let's not make it the last.
Oh my gosh. And if you want to follow Kishore's live stream of that, you can go follow him on Twitter at ScienceKish. I'm sure he'll be tweeting out a link if you'll be broadcasting your reactions.
What time will you be broadcasting?
The NASA stream starts at 11:30 or 11:15 Pacific tomorrow.
All right. Cool.
All right. Fingers crossed. Let's make this happen. And with that will be it for this show. We have an outro again from Great Job. From the archives, I'm going to run out of these once in a while. Hey, if you have an outro you want to send, please send it our way. You can always email it to me or post it to me in Discord or send it to me on a DM. But here goes. This one's called "I Feel Lucky."
Hi there, I didn't see you.
That's it.
Okay, Netflix announced that they are introducing a shuffle button.
No, hey guys, remember when we all used to hit the "I'm feeling lucky" button on Google? No. Remember that? Remember how we used to use that feature and continue to use that feature all the time?
That is different. This is truly like chat roulette.
And they never released that feature.
They didn't?
I don't think they ever did. That's funny. No.